chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them, but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. I'm your host, Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Hello, everyone. We're living in a time that requires so much nuance to navigate appropriately and safely and ethically. So Eliza and I thought it'd be a great way to kick off the second week of Christmas in July by talking about a movie that has no nuance.
None whatsoever.
So please, let's give a hearty welcome back to Eliza, everybody. Eliza's back on the show, and I'm so excited.
Hey, I'm happy to be back. It's been a few weeks.
Eliza, what is this nuanceless movie we're talking about today?
Oh, today we are going to be talking about Christmas in the Smokies. Available to stream on Netflix currently.
Of course,
although
of course.
It, according to IMDb, was actually released in a couple of theaters in the year of our Lord 2015 when it first came out, which is amazing.
Eliza, I wish so much that we could have seen this film in theaters, like, too much.
I would have thrown so much popcorn at the screen.
Okay, we have to get into this. So without further ado, here's your summary, which is not from Google, because the Google summary is literally one sentence. That's the kind of movie we're dealing with here, folks. Here's our summary. Clinging to the only life she's ever known, a headstrong woman, along with her loving parents, finds herself on the verge of losing her family's berry farm. Berry farm? Okay, we'll get into that. In the heart of the Smoky Mountains, to an impending retail expansion. Over one eventful holiday season, she tries every avenue possible to save the farm. But when the local town leaders notify her that they will have to seize the property after the holidays, her last hope to unite the town is to throw a Christmas concert on the farm, headlined by her former love, a ne'er-do-well country music star. As the day of the concert approaches, they all must learn the value of family, faith, and community before time runs out. Well, wow. Eliza, that is what the website for Christmas in the Smokies says that the film is about. But if we really get down to the deep, deep intellectual nuancelessness of this movie, what is it really about?
You know, I think that description may actually have been longer and more complex than the film itself. That was the whole thing. You've missed nothing now. You don't need to watch the movie. This movie is a part of a current and a contemporary tradition of bland, unnuanced, feel-good Christmas rom-coms, generally made for TV movies, that shove Christmas down the throats of their viewers in a way that is just barely palatable and generally pretty forgettable. And this movie in particular falls onto the one of side of the two-sided coin that these movies fall into, which is that this one is aggressively Christian. There's a strange sort of tendency with Christmas movies, even though they are set at Christmas and entirely about Christmas, to really be pretty secular and sort of a-religious. And there's plenty of Lifetime or Hallmark or Netflix Christmas movies that fall into that category. But for every one of those, there's also these ones that shove the religious Christian meaning of Christmas down your throat. And this movie is definitely one of those. It is really sort of astounding how much from the get-go you've got like the down-home vibes and the messages about the reason for the season on the radio. And that's what this movie is about. And also there's a 30-year-old woman who can't be happy until she has a boyfriend. And at the end of the movie, she does.
A true lesson for all of us at Christmas.
Absolutely. You can't be happy unless you have a boyfriend and it's Christmas and also Jesus is there.
Eliza, yes. So there is, if you haven't seen this film, listeners, there is a refrain in this film that is supposed to be meaningful, but I don't understand for the life of me what it means. They keep saying, "I believe that there's a baby born in that manger." And every time that they say it, I can't help but think about Ricky Bobby in Talladega Nights talking about baby Jesus, and specifically the baby Jesus and the importance of the baby Jesus. And Eliza, I just have to know, what is the significance of believing that the baby was born in the manger? I just have to know.
Well, let's start off by saying that the theology of this movie is tenuous at best. I think in the first moment in this movie where that phrasing is brought up, the main character's father, the main character has talked about the fact that they might lose the farm, you know, which is a very sort of standard plot device in this kind of a thing. And her father is trying to say, don't worry about it, it'll take care of itself. And he points to their nativity scene and says, I believe there was a baby born in that manger. And what he's trying to say in that moment is that miracles and great things can happen through God who strengthens us, essentially. You know, the story of Mary and Joseph being locked out of the inn and being stuck in a stable and having to give birth and lay the baby in the manger. The idea is supposed to be that great things come from humble beginnings and that God finds a way, even if it's not the you know, expected way. I don't know that that particular religious message really translates to we're about to lose our farm because we're not making enough money. Don't worry, it'll all work itself out by Christmas. I don't think that's what God intended when he wrote it down in the Bible. But I'm not a theology scholar, so maybe I'm wrong.
You know, Eliza, I wrote down in my notes to this very point, because I was thinking about this. I was like, what is the significance, or what is going to be the significance of the baby in this manger? Are they going to have a baby? Is there going to be an Immaculate Conception plot? Because I'm here for that. But instead, the first time, there's a lot of distinctly religious Christian Christmas music in this film, which I have no problem with. But what's interesting about it is the first time we hear it very distinctly, there's a sequence where our main heroine, Shelby Bell, with her very Southern name and her very non-existent Southern accent in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. How does that happen? Who knows? But she rolls up in her truck with this religious Christmas music playing, and she rolls out the plans for a new farm, for this expanded plot of land. And you know what I wrote in my notes? The prosperity doctrine. That is what I wrote down in my notes.
Yes. This is, I would call it prosperity doctrine light, because it doesn't shove it down your throat. If you're aware of it, you see it. But that's absolutely what's happening. It's saying if you're a good Christian woman and you stand by your family and you stand by your beliefs, then you're going to make money and your farm's going to be successful and your family's going to be happy. And I personally have many, many issues with that theology, but it is always very sort of disconcerting to see it presented so surface level, where it's just sort of this like bland, happy story where that's just kind of sprinkled on the top in a way that clearly the expected audience for this movie is supposed to just understand that message. You know, this isn't teaching them the message. This is just, you already know it, and everything you consume contains that message or revolves around that message. And so your Christmas movies also will.
Right. It's a reassurance to the audience that it's like that wink, wink, and nudge, nudge. Like, you know this is going to end well, but let's be like very, very clear that you know that this is going to end very well for Shelby Bell and her family. And the villain being this like enterprising man in a bolo tie, which I laughed about for approximately 15 minutes because every villain in a Southern themed film has a bolo tie. And I'm not sure why, because they're a lovely, lovely accessory that have no association with evil as far as I can tell. And yet people love to make these movies with evil guys wearing bolo ties.
You're totally right. What's that about?
I don't know. I think it's just because it's so Southern and it just seems so weird to people from not from the South that people just take that as like, it's got to be trouble because I don't recognize it.
I wonder if there's something too about the businessman wearing the bolo tie thing that we're supposed to take it as insincere, you know, because otherwise he's like wearing suits and everything, but he's got this little Southern element to him as if, you know, he's trying to put it on for the locals, maybe.
I think there's some truth to that because Shelby does accuse him of not caring about the town. Although it's weird because we don't get the sense that he's an out-of-towner. He has an office in town. He goes into the local bank all the time.
The scene where the two of them face off in the, like, town meeting, watching it this time around, and I had seen this movie once before, I watched it last Christmas, you know, when I was bored at home, and watching it this time around, I just kept thinking during that scene, she's coming off worse in this scene. You know, he does this whole thing about the town relies on the economy of, he says, like, you know, down in the valley or something. Like, there's clearly bigger cities not too far away, and he wants to build, you know, essentially a shopping center, but with restaurants and stores where people in town can sell their wares and where people from out of town can come in. And then she stands up and is like, but I don't want my farm to be taken away. And that's her whole argument. I just kept thinking, if I was sitting in this town meeting, I don't think I'd side with Shelby.
Yeah, this is where the prosperity doctrine moment kind of meets how Shelby is like a real shell of a character, where you're not quite sure why you're rooting for her, except for the fact that you keep following her around.
Oh, can I also say, this killed me. So the whole thing is she doesn't want to lose her family's farm, and, you know, they've had it for forever and blah, blah, blah. But when she's yelling at the banker, who's clearly a family friend, she says, that farm has been in our family for 40 years. And she's got to be 30 years old. I mean, she's not a young, young kid. And I just kept thinking, been in our family. That just means your parents bought it when they got married. Like, they're easily 70. That 40 years, it's not like it's been there for generations. Like, you grew up on this farm. That's what you mean. It's not like she's like, you know, we've lived here since, you know, like the time of the Civil War or, you know, whatever. She's saying, like, we bought this a couple decades ago, and now after having a decently successful business for that time, it's time for my parents to retire. And that makes me angry.
You know, Eliza, this might actually explain why Shelby Bell has no discernible Smoky Mountain, Tennessee accent, which, by the way, listeners, is a very distinct accent, because if you can conjure what Dolly Parton sounds like, that is somebody from the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. That is a very distinct accent. Miss Shelby Bell is missing one entirely.
She's got a little twang. Like, maybe she's from Virginia.
You know, the actress, like, maybe she's from Kansas. I looked this up. I was okay. Like, she's a Midwestern gal. I don't feel anything Southern about this woman.
There you go. Good to know. Her prospective mate has quite a voice. I'm not sure if it's an accurate accent, but he's certainly putting it on. Mr. Mason Wyatt.
Which another is wonderful Southern name. He is actually born in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay.
I looked up.
Oh, he's got a good voice. He sings in it. I feel like Mason Wyatt is a good, like, bland Southern character name, because you could flip the two names and it would be exactly the same.
Oh, it's a magnificent, both of the names, Shelby Bell and Mason Wyatt, are just magnificent Southern romance novel names in the best way. Let's actually get into Mr. Mason Wyatt as a romantic figure here. He is a little bit of the archetype of the cowboy who travels from town to town for some reason, because Shelby meets him. And now here, walk through this with me, Eliza, because I need to figure out this timeline. So he and Shelby got together when she was 17, at least. We're not quite sure how old he was at that time, but he had come through town to play his first gig in town. Now, presumably he was also 18 and they started to be boyfriend and girlfriend, but did he just, like, take up residence at a local cafe to keep performing? I was very confused.
There's mention of his parents dying about 10 years ago. And I think what's supposed to be understood is that they moved to town when he was in, like, high school, and he started to get big on the music scene, and then he moved away, his parents died, and he didn't come back.
Right, and Shelby, like any good 30-year-old
so
woman,
mad about that.
Has never gotten over the guy she dated for 5 minutes at 17.
The moment when her mother says, I remember when you two were together and you, I'd never seen you happier. And I was like, because she was a 17-year-old girl with a boyfriend. Like, are you really telling your 30-year-old daughter that she should date the guy who dumped her 13 years ago?
And the thing about it is, Eliza, though, that, like, I had these same thoughts. I went through a whole journey with their relationship through the movie, and not in a way that the film intended me to, but on my own journey.
A different journey than Shelby.
Yes, a different journey from Shelby's, where I was thinking at first, like, why do these two characters like each other? Because it really, they're we're given no reason for them to like each other other than the fact that they used to date once.
And it's Christmas.
Which is kind of hilarious. And it's Christmas. Which is funny, because he's like a country music star.
Yeah.
So there's not that, like, charisma, really. He's got that small town boy charm, sure. But there's not that charisma. There's not that, like, superstar, like, cocky attitude. There's no, like, talk between them about common interests, for example. I was confused. And she also hates the way he dances, which, can we talk about that dance scene that he did on the Countryfied Dancing with the Stars, which I kept asking, is this the director's cut of this dancing
his
scene?
Whole, because... It went on forever. His whole trajectory is like what someone who's never achieved or interacted with fame and success believes fame and success looks like. Which I suppose is a pretty scathing indictment of the writer and director of this movie. And they're probably sorry, lovely y'all. People, and I do apologize. But it's, they're like, he became a big music star, like, in one moment. And then the next moment, they're like, he's not even B-list. He's on this, like, shitty TV show for has-beens. And you're like, wait, is he, like, not even famous, or is he a has-been? And then he's on the show, which is the lowest production value thing I've ever seen. Like, when you're in a Hallmark Christmas movie, and the show within a show has low production value in comparison to the Hallmark movie you're in, like, that's not good. And it's, like, this, like, shitty country music spinoff of Dancing with the Stars. But they say it's the biggest show in America. And then he bombs it, and he's like, I had to come hide out because everyone thought that, like, I was such a cocky asshole on this show. But, like, it also doesn't really seem like anyone outside of the town saw it. So, like, why would you return to the town? None of it makes sense. They just are sort of like, what are buzzwords for, like, rich and left home? And then they just throw all of them in there, even when they all mean disparate things.
And also, can we just briefly touch on, so everyone, as we're moving to the climax of the film and we're getting to the part where Mason Wyatt is going to help Shelby Bell save her farm through a miraculous Christmas concert at their farm. He knows that this is the plan, and yet he gets a call from his agent, and his agent is like, hey, I heard that you're going to do a Christmas show on Christmas Eve in the afternoon, but can you do an evening show in Seattle? And Mason Wyatt, the brain dead robot, says, yeah, I can make both of those things work. And when he brings that to Shelby and he says, hey, I'm going to do the show on the Christmas during the day, and then in the night I'm going to go off and go to Seattle, her reaction is not what a reasonable person's reaction would be, which is, it's going to take you 4 to 5 hours to fly from Tennessee in the middle of nowhere to Seattle, so how are you going to make that timeline work? No, her response is, how dare you leave me again, as you did when we were 17. It's so weird.
It's wild, because he says time and time again, he's like, don't worry, I'm going to be here in time, and it's all going to work out. Like, I know it's not what we planned, but, like, I'm going to make it work. And instead of saying, okay, explain this scheduling to me again because I don't trust you, right? It's not that she's like, I think you're an idiot. She's just like, I can't believe you're bailing on us. And he presented it to her as, I will still perform at this concert that we have planned. And she's so mad.
And it's like, she's like, you're bailing on me. But to this point, she has only ever been mean to him. And he's only ever said, like, as you wish, basically.
Oh my God, that's totally what's happened. They are first seen, Wesley and Buttercup.
It's so true. Like, he is the most, like, malleable, placid person that I think
she
I've ever seen in a film.
She charges him $5,000 to spend, like, 6 nights in their barn. And he, who has claimed he has money issues, is like, yeah, that's fine.
And this is, I mean, to give the writers credit, this is consistent with other scenes. Like, the one in which he goes into the local, like, I was about to say deli, but there are no delis in this town. The
convenience
local
store, I don't know.
Yeah, the local drugstore, probably. And he crashes, like, Shelby's dad's Friday lunch. He sits down to talk to a local waitress who is in a totally different movie. And she basically asks him approximately 58 different questions about customizing his breakfast order. And he just lets her go. He doesn't stop her. He doesn't use, like, letting being a celebrity, like, stop her from being so ridiculous. He just lets her go.
She's
quietly.
Also fully orgasming during that entire scene.
Yes.
She's like, and did you want eggs? What is going on?
Yeah, I truly don't know, because he is, like, a very good looking gentleman. I did have these moments where I was like, well, you are a handsome cowboy with some very nice blue eyes, and you did not really have to do much to do well in this movie, and I understand that.
He's got decent voice, too. Like, they did good on the casting of him.
They did. They really did. I don't know that he and Shelby quite had chemistry. I don't know that I would say that.
I don't think there was enough anything happening on the screen to qualify as chemistry. It wasn't bad. you know, sometimes you're like, oh, those two people have opposite chemistry. It wasn't that. It was just more like they were both acting in different rooms.
Yeah, after I watched the movie, my mom asked me how it was, and I told her that it was like watching someone take two dolls that can't talk and putting them together and saying, you're in love, now kiss.
Except that they don't kiss. Spoiler alert, this movie is so wholesome that it ends on a completely chaste level with them slow dancing on her porch to no music with her head on his shoulder.
Listen, that, you know what, that is a, I respect that, although I did wonder at that time, I was thinking, goodness me, is Shelby Bell this level of, like, beautiful, attractive woman who runs a not very successful farm, but at any rate has land, in a town like this, who's a good Christian girl, this girl has not been married off yet by 30? I'm surprised by this, y'all. I don't know. I don't know if I... You know, I worry about Miss Shelby Bell.
I had a couple questions about Shelby Bell's personality and her portrayal in this movie, because the writers do go out of the way to make it clear that she is a strong-willed, independent woman, which is already, it's so eye-rolly when it's a movie about the fact that she can't be happy until she has a boyfriend, to then be like, no, but really, like, she's confident and independent. But they really go out of their way to make it clear that, like, she has ownership of her parents' farm, and she has a relationship with every business in town, and she, like, runs a whole charity group at the local children's hospital, which this small hill town has, apparently, you know, and all this kind of stuff, but has absolutely zero independence or control when it comes to her love life. Every single person she talks to in the entire movie is like, well, I really think you should be with Mason Wyatt, and so does everyone else. And then they just, like, shove her into a room with him and lock the door behind them. I mean, it's really amazing. And she just sort of goes along with it. Like, she complains about it, but she just sort of, he shows up at the charity event she's doing at the hospital to sing, and she just stands there and smiles at him. She's not like, you weren't on the docket. You know, she has no agency whatsoever in this one aspect of her life after they've attempted to write her as having complete agency in every other aspect. I found it inconsistent. And I don't know if they were trying to say, you know, she's hard and determined to make up for the fact that she has no love life. I don't know if they were trying to just say she's really in love with this guy and so she'll let anyone push them together. But it wasn't, whatever it wasn't actually there. You had to kind of guess.
Yeah, I wonder, come to think of it, if that's another, like, subtle part of the, oh, we said there were no nuances, but maybe there are. A subtle part of the theology of this movie that, because she sort of fell for Mason Wyatt at 17, her hardness and her determination was a response to him implicitly rejecting her when they were meant to be, like, these soulmates, these sort of, like, predestined partners in life. Perhaps. Mm.
I feel like that's the novelization of this movie. Like, if this were a movie that was based on chick lit, that would be in the book and wouldn't have made it quite as explicitly into the movie. Because there's definitely the framework for that. There also, I do want to comment, since we're in Christmas in July month, I do want to sort of swing us around to the sort of broader things happening here too, which is that they live in this magical land where everything revolves around Christmas. You know, she's got a line, this town loves Christmas, and the, like, black mayor who also owns the general store is like, we sure do. But, you know, they...
A magical place indeed.
They're doing, like, a crossword puzzle, and the question is about Christmas foods. And her friend works at a Christmas tree farm. Like, she's Taylor Swift. And, you know, and every radio station is just playing O Come All Ye Faithful, like, the whole time. And you know, and it's so sort of typical of these kind of movies where they exist in this world where when December 1st hits, the entire world becomes about Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it is that we sort of, that so many people crave these, like, Christmas-obsessed movies. And I certainly, any one of my friends is going to call me out right now on being a hypocrite because I am absolutely Christmas-obsessed and my entire December is about Christmas. Like, this is true for anyone who knows me. But the world around me doesn't suddenly become entirely about Christmas, you know, right? Like, there are still stores that just, like, play music or, you know, you can like open a book and it's not every book you read your child for the entire month of December is, you know, a Christmas book. Like, that's not really how it works, but in these movies there's this almost fantastical element where like they flip a switch.
Oh yeah, it's like, and I think that the kind of like Southern Appalachian setting and also the Christian sort of theology of the movie all plays into that, right? That like, mm-hmm. oh well, in the United States, like, we know that while urban settings are often the prime settings for Christmas movies, like American classics, mm-hmm. There's something about the like pastoral Southern Appalachian area that feels very distinctly about the reason for the season idea, right? Like, this right. is a magical land where we can say Merry Christmas to everyone. We never have to say Happy Holidays. And Christmas can be about the baby in that manger.
Happy birthday, so baby Jesus.
There too. Happy birthday, baby Jesus. And I think that there is something, especially if that is a theology that's important to you, there's definitely a kind of like special magic to a movie like this in a setting.
Absolutely. And there is this sort of idea that exists in all of these movies, and we'll come back to this in the next few weeks too as we cover a couple other movies, but that on Christmas magic is possible and everyone is happy by Christmas, or else often is sort of the messaging of these things. And so, you know, they're about to lose the farm and they throw this big concert where everyone in the town comes together and like pitches in, and the, you know, the possibly shitty boyfriend turns out to be not shitty and he plays and they raise money and they still haven't raised enough. But then at like 11 o'clock at night on December 24th, this woman from this chain of grocery stores calls and says, "We want to carry your jams and your pies in our stores. We'll send you the check on the 26th. You know, and it's just this level of like someone at some point, whether it's Santa or baby Jesus or just the spirit of Christmas himself, is going to like tap you with a magic wand and it's all going to fall into place.
Yes, and I think that what's interesting about that for me with this particular movie, to tie it all together, is that that also feels like, in some ways, an encapsulation of the prosperity doctrine, which mm-hmm. is, you know, the day will come, that day will probably be Christmas, when God will finally smile upon you and give you the riches that you deserve, including the boyfriend of your dreams, which is part of the haul of those riches.
Absolutely. Yes, there's a definite, like, and it's a trade-off, right? The prosperity doctrine is a, you do this for me and I do this for you, but instead of being between two people, it's between a person and God, or, as is more often the case, a person and their very, very wealthy televangelist pastor. But it's this idea that, like, Shelby volunteers with the sick children at the hospital, and her parents are good, upstanding members of the town, and so it doesn't matter how many crappy ex-boyfriends come to town, how many bolo tie wearing bad guys try to buy their land, like, they will be given prosperity and happiness in exchange for it. And ideally it'll happen by Christmas Eve.
And it doesn't matter how mean she is to Mason Wyatt, who does, as we said, pretty much give her everything she wants.
Yeah, he's a pretty decent guy.
It doesn't matter how mean she is the whole time. He is going to fall into her arms because they are meant to be, because it's Christmas, magic mm-hmm. is possible, and at Christmas you fall in love.
Right. The odd thing I find about that in this movie is that he gives up this gig that would put him back on the map for her. And it's this moment where I'm like, I don't know why he takes her back at the end when she's made him give up this thing that would have brought his career back up front and center and would have meant he made enough money to save the farm.
See, that's exactly the weird thing about this movie, is that it happens in, like, this is a movie that happens in a snow globe, you guys. Nothing that is real that could, like, impact the plot in like a positive and interesting way comes to be. Like, that plot doesn't come in. The idea that Mason Wyatt could play this gig and like bring Shelby back the money, which would have been a very compelling plot, could happen. And then there's also this very strange scene where, as I said, Mason Wyatt comes into the local drugstore and sees Shelby's dad having dinner, having lunch with his boys, which includes the black mayor of the town, and also a black man we come to learn was the gym teacher at their high school. Now, that scene is so interesting to me because it almost feels like this idealistic idea of what interracial friendships and interracial mm-hmm. relationships are like in small towns in Appalachia, Which certainly can be like this. In some ways, this felt like the most realistic Southern scene to me as a Southerner.
Mm-hmm.
But in other ways, it did sort of feel like this fantastical, like, lovely idea of a idealistic town where you could have a black mayor in Appalachia, and you could have a black gym teacher and have everybody get along and there not be these racial tensions ever thought of. And to believe that, you know, rural people are not going to be losing their farms, which they so often are. You know, there's mm-hmm. something, like, really beautiful about that, but it is very idealistic.
Yes, it's a nice idea of what it could be, but it doesn't come across as truly authentic, unfortunately. I will give this movie some props for its racial politics. They clearly made an effort to put non-white characters into relative positions of power. The woman who works for the grocery store chain that ultimately is their saving grace and, you know, signs them on and so that she saves the farm is also a black woman. She and her husband are, like, coming through the town on their Christmas vacation and stopping at all the local stores, and that's how they discover it. You've got this black mayor. You've got a couple other sort of black friends kind of sprinkled throughout in a few of the scenes, which I always make note of in these kind of movies because they tend to be so overbearingly white. But I will also say that this movie would never have been written with black leads. You know, right. The two love interests are still very, very white. And so while it's clear that the producers of this movie did make an effort to not just have a completely whitewashed story, it still exists within the, you know, within the culture that all of these movies exist in, where it is gathering a mostly white audience on whatever venue it's being released on, and therefore still needs to be a white-centric story. So there's complex issues going on there, but I will give it some credit for making an effort when it clearly didn't need to. They could have just cast an entirely white cast and still would have been picked up by all the same production companies.
Any final thoughts we want to offer about Christmas in the Smokies?
I mean, you know, if you need something really bland to turn on at some point in December while you're cooking, like, this is fine.
I think that's a great tagline for this movie. This is fine.
I think when listening to us talk for the last half hour, you could probably drink every time we said Mason Wyatt and get a really nice Christmas buzz going.
And he does, as I said, if you're into masculine types, I mean, the blue eyes are happening. He's got a fine-looking figure.
He's
there.
Got some nice blue eyes, and he has a surprising amount of gray hair for a relatively young guy. They're letting him already move into that silver fox range. And I don't know if that kind of works with the country star image more than it would work with, like, the pop star image or what, but it works for me on him.
Oh, yeah. It was working on me. It was. It was confusing because I still don't really know what age he or Shelby are.
Very unclear.
Very unclear. But
her parents are quite elderly, and his are both dead.
So,
and I can't imagine they live in a town where everyone's waiting until they're 35 to get married and have babies. So, like, I'm guessing the parents probably had them pretty young.
Yes. Same. So Shelby Bell and Mason Wyatt, they held off for each other. See, where's my novelization of Christmas in the Smokies, producer? Like, bring me that deep, deep backstory about relationships in Appalachia. Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, let's transition here. As always, I want to give a shout out to our patrons on Patreon who are always the best. And we're wishing you a merry, merry Christmas in July. Those patrons are Bob, Esther, Robert, M, and Sean. Y'all are the best.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
All right, Eliza. I feel like this is going to be so fun. What is your antidote for Christmas in the Smokies?
Well, I have to say, I didn't anticipate this, but my antidote was inspired by an actual line in the movie. There is a scene where they're on the radio plugging this miracle concert they're going to throw, and they're asking our darling Mason Wyatt about what Christmas music he loves. And he gives a pretty decent list, I gotta say. I mean, it's a little heavy on the country for my taste, but all the albums he lists are good Christmas albums. And he mentions my personal favorite Christmas album, which is John Denver and the Muppets. And so if you like Christmas music, but you don't know where to start, I mean, one, send me a message. I'll send you 1,000 different albums to go listen to. But start with John Denver and the Muppets. It's a great album. It's got some funny songs. It's got some really dear songs. When I'm really in the Christmas spirit and have had a couple glasses of eggnog, it's not hard for it to make me cry. It's really, really lovely. So go listen to that if you ever want to listen to some good Christmas music. And jumping off of that, if you want a good Christmas movie that also has a very heartfelt, and I would argue still pretty strongly Christian message, watch A Muppet Christmas Carol. It is the absolute best version of A Christmas Carol out there. Don't argue with me on this. I will fight you. I will win because I am stubborn and convinced I am right, much like Leslie Knope at all times. But it is absolutely wonderful. Kermit and Miss Piggy are completely fabulous in it. Michael Caine plays Scrooge in one of the greatest performances of his life. The music itself is also just unbelievably wonderful and will become part of your regular Christmas rotation. Check that out.
My antidotes similarly are very music-based. But I, you know, big secret, big confession here, y'all. Despite a entire youth of resisting it, as an adult, I have come to love country music. And so I have a bit of a country music bundle here for you if your draw to this movie is the music of the great country B, A-level star. Hard to tell. I want to start by recommending the amazing, truly amazing podcast by Jad Abumrad from Radiolab and WNYC called Dolly Parton's America, which is an incredible investigation of Dolly Parton's impact on American culture and also her tenuous relationship with feminism and the public eye and her skill as an artist, as well as her relationship to Appalachia in the setting of this film. I also want to recommend an artist that I have fallen totally head over heels in love with, and their name is Evil. And Evil recently had a takeover of the country music artist Orville Peck, who I've recommended on the show before, of his Instagram account, where she had a whole post series on Black country music and the origins of country music in Black Appalachia. Evil is a Black person from Appalachia, and their music, in addition to the playlist that they put in this takeover stream called Black Country Matters, is a game changer. I've listened to it all week. It's fabulous. So go check that out. It's all archived on Orville Peck's Instagram page. And then finally, in this huge bundle of country music that I'm laying on for you, I want to make sure that if you don't already know, the great Kacey Musgraves has a Christmas special that came out this past year, and it's so charming and so lovely, and she's such a great example of left-of-center country, and she's just a doll. So if you're looking for some fun country Christmas vibes, I recommend Kacey Musgraves' Christmas special.
Oh, I love that. And it's since you so mentioned good. Dolly, if you want something that's just going to make you feel good about the world, go look up Dolly Parton's Imagination Library or Dolly Parton Book Club. If you Google that, it'll bring it up. It's a program that she's had running for years that gives free books to kids in underprivileged areas from the time that they're essentially born until they start in elementary school. It's an incredible program that has totally changed the world, especially in Appalachia, of pre-official education, children's education. It's really wonderful. And if you're just feeling like really shitty about the world right now, go look that up and it'll make you feel a lot better.
True facts, Eliza, I did, when I finished this movie, think, like, this movie needed more Dolly Parton. Like, if Shelby Bell's mom had been played by Dolly Parton, I would have been so happy.
Or had just, like, referenced Dolly Parton in every other sentence, which I feel like also would have felt pretty authentic.
It would, I mean, it would have. Like, come on, y'all. Where are my Dolly Parton rom-coms? Netflix, make this happen. Make it happen.
We'll work on that.
Aww. All right, well, thank you, Eliza, for coming on and talking you, about this movie.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Eliza.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked this episode, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Rom-Com Killjoys. And if you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys to gain access to exclusive bonus content. Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog. And the song you're listening to now is a cover of one of my favorites, Baby Love, by Colin Langanis. Thank you. Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy. Not a rom-com, not me, not anyone. See you next time.
I'm gonna sound so drunk on this recording because I am.